Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
China says it welcomes U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit and will focus on five key missions in the bilateral talks. Nearly 200 Navy representatives from dozens of countries gathered this week in eastern China to attend the Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao. The main ruling party in the Maldives, the People's National Congress, has won the country's parliamentary election. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting China from Wednesday to Friday this week. China says it welcomes the visit and will focus on five key missions. Qi Zhi has the details.
Blinken's visit follows a phone conversation between the leaders of the two countries earlier this month. An official at the Chinese Foreign Ministry says China and the United States should stabilize and improve relations and follow a path of healthy and sustainable development. The official also says China is open to communication and urges Washington to match its action with words. On properly managing differences, the official says China will elaborate on its stance on the Taiwan question and issues concerning the South China Sea, as well as trade and technology. One other mission is boosting win-win cooperation. The foreign ministry official says China has taken great measures in joint efforts to combat drug trafficking and hopes the U.S. will address China's legitimate concerns. China also says the two countries should shoulder their responsibilities as major countries. Beijing says it hopes Washington will follow its example and play a constructive role in major issues, such as the conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine. The official stresses that China has always handled bilateral relations on the principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, but warned the U.S. that China will respond to any action that infringes on its internal affairs and damages its legitimate interests.
That was Qi Zhi with the report. Now, for more on this trip and the general China-U.S. relations, I earlier talked to Victor Gao, chair professor at Suzhou University. Thank you, Victor, for joining me. Now, ahead of the meeting, China's foreign ministry released a statement explaining China's five goals for this visit by Blinken. Overall, how do you see the remarks?
Thank you very much for having me. I think China is fully prepared to warmly welcome Secretary of State Blinken's visit to China. His visit will take place in the immediate aftermath of the recent visit by Secretary of Treasury Yellen. And these high-level visits are contributive to the normalization of relations between China and the United States and hopefully will pave the groundwork for better and more constructive relations between China and the United States. On the other hand, I think China is fully justified to draw a line and set up the parameters for the talk with Secretary of State Blinken himself, as well as for the future development of China-U.S. relations. First of all, I think China wants to set the basic tone of the bilateral relations, not only for the United States, but for both countries, but also for the global audience. That is, China and the United States should pursue their bilateral relations out of mutual respect of each other, and should abandon any crazy idea of, let's say, a Cold War or great power rivalry, because that will not be good for either China or the United States. And I hope Secretary of State Blinken will listen very carefully as to what China has put on the record. And when she talks to the Chinese leaders in the coming few days, he will bear this in mind and use this as the parameter for the discussions between China and the United States. The United States should not be encouraged to bully China or to speak down to China or try to impose its version of the truth onto China. China and the United States should deal with each other completely as equals and respect each other's view rather than try to impose one's version onto the other side.
Well, Victor, on trade and economic relations, some American politicians and media have been hyping up the theory of overcapacity in China's grain industries. How would you respond to such claims?
First of all, let's zoom in on what Washington is talking about. If they are talking about overcapacity in the electric vehicle or the new NEV cars, for example, this is completely out of touch with the reality. Let me give you some numbers. For the year 2023, China altogether produced more than 30 billion vehicles. Only up to about less than 10 million were EV cars. That means EV car as a percentage of the total production in China for 2023 was less than one-third. That is around 30%. Now, the EV industry itself is a sunrise industry. It's just beginning. It is very much developing rapidly in China, and it will develop very much rapidly in the rest of the world. But only looking at China, it's around one-third of the market. It will need to go up to 50%, 75%, and by the end of the day, when the dust really settles, it will be up to 100%. So you have a lot of things to go on to, not only for the China market, but for the rest of the world. I think Washington is not really talking about the production capacities of the EV. They are really talking about now that the United States is at a disadvantage as far as the EV production is concerned, they want to restrict or prohibit the China-made EV cars from entering into the U.S. market. Therefore, the so-called overcapacity is not reflecting the realities on the ground. It is being misused as an excuse to practice protectionism and to prevent or to limit Chinese export of EV cars into the United States. But on the other hand, allow me to emphasize another point. If there is any competition as far as EV cars are concerned, the real competition is not between China versus the United States or China versus Germany or China versus Japan. It is the EV, which represents the future, much better and much cleaner as far as emission is concerned, versus the old car, that is the fuel car, which is something of the past. The United States has developed the fuel car industry very importantly as a pillar of their economy. There are sensitivities to be taken care of, but by preventing the rapid development of EV, it is not good for the sustainable development of the automobile industry in the United States to start with, and eventually the United States will really need to embrace the EV car. And the best way for the United States to embrace the EV car revolution is to cooperate with China rather than obstructing a Chinese vehicle from entering the U.S. market.
Well, that is certainly the hope. The two sides have a lot of issues to cover. On security, on the South China Sea, U.S., Philippines, and Japan have been teaming up in their recent leaders' meeting against China. How do you see the U.S., the role of the United States in this? What about the ramifications of these actions taken by the three in the Asia Pacific?
Talking about the United States versus the Philippines or versus the South China Sea, allow me to mention one point, very important, and I hope your global audience will really listen very carefully to what I say. I think the United States is probably one of the very few countries which should know the situation involving the South China Sea better. Why? Because when Japan unconditionally surrendered to the United States, to China, and to the former Soviet Union and to the United Kingdom in August 1945. Japan unconditionally surrendered. And at that time, Japan was sitting on all the islands and isles and reefs and atolls in the South China Sea. Now, the United States under General MacArthur took back the Philippines, meaning whatever that belonged to the Philippines was taken back by the United States in 1945. Meaning, logically, whatever the United States didn't take back in 19, 1945 did not belong to the Philippines. That's a very important historical date to keep in mind. And when Japan surrendered all the islands, the Iyo Atoll and reefs in the South China Sea, do you know to whom Japan surrendered all these islands and reefs and atolls? Japan surrendered everything to China.
Mm.
Why? Because China was, at the time, probably the only country still standing on its feet in this part of the world after 8 years or even 40 years of resistance against Japanese aggression.
Mm.
And other countries, Malaysia was a British colony, Indonesia was a Dutch colony, Vietnam was a French colony, and the Philippines was not an independent sovereign country. It was kind of a possession of the United States, occupied by Japan during the Second World War and reclaimed by the United States. Therefore, I hope Washington will go back into their archive and do a real good work in researching the origins of this situation. Now, as far as Japan is concerned, allow me to emphasize another point. Japan unconditionally surrendered in 1945, and any deployment of Japanese military forces outside of Japan is against the pacifist constitution in Japan and is actually against its undertaking to China when Japan unconditionally surrendered in August 1945. Therefore, the United States should really not play with fire by encouraging to Japan to violate its pacifist constitution, to violate its commitments undertaken when it unconditionally surrendered to the United States, but also to China in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Because a rearmed Japan, violating its pacifist constitution, violating its solemn commitments undertaken when it unconditionally surrendered to China in 1945, will create havoc and instability and even military conflicts or war in this part of the world.
Mm.
Therefore, when we talk about the situation between China on the one hand and the United States and Japan and the Philippines on the other hand, China needs to stand firm on matters of principle and fully protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And the United States really needs to do its homework to look at the origin of the situation and not really pick one side against the other in the South China Sea to start with, and not allow Japan to rearm itself and to violate its pacifist constitution and to overturn its commitments undertaken when it unconditionally surrendered to China in 1945.
That was Victor Gao, chair professor at Suzhou University. Coming up, China hosts the Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
I'm back in Korea.
Home.
I love you, Betty.
Love.
Remember?
Thank you.
Bing an.
Fate.
Take care.
Mi-tun.
What do they truly mean?
Dasha, where did you go? Dasha!
Embark on a century-long journey with CGTN Radio's latest offering, Echoes of Culion, a gripping audio drama series inspired by real-life tales.
Has anyone heard of a Kodasha?
From unexpected encounters to heartfelt reunions, immerse yourself in a narrative of love, peace, and enduring friendship.
He's a piece of my lost childhood.
Listen to Echoes of Culion on radio.cgtn.com and all major podcast platforms.
Bing An.
Welcome back to World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Nearly 200 Navy representatives from dozens of countries have gathered this week in eastern China to attend the Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao. This year, the event coincides with the 75th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, Navy. Zhang Yunfei reports from Qingdao.
China's Vice Chairman of the Central Military Commission, Zhang Youxia, delivered the keynote speech. And in the speech, he stressed on the new challenges and opportunities that the world is facing, especially given the maritime situation. He calls on all parties participating to abandon the Cold War mentality and promote peaceful development. And he specifically mentioned about promoting dialogue when it comes to new risks in the modern battlefield. He stressed on the potential threats brought by the new technologies as well as especially unmanned system. And that's why in this year's symposium, unmanned system is being widely discussed, and China has proposed to establish a research work project about the unmanned system over the maritime situation that is coordinated by the PLA Navy. This is the event that is really gathering the participation of a diversity, wide range of participating countries, including the delegations from the United States and delegation from Russia. However, in the morning gathering, the Philippines delegation has unexpectedly didn't show up, and I asked the PLA officials why.
As far as I know, China as a host of this symposium has extended the invitations to all member states and observer states. We're not sure about the specific reasons why the Philippines is not attending the event. However, I believe that with the joint efforts of all member states and observer states attending the meeting, the symposium will definitely inject positive energy in promoting maritime security cooperation and mutual trust among the member states and observer states.
Meanwhile, the United States and the Philippines are conducting joint military drills in the South China Sea. At the same time, China says the symposium will gather participation around the table for dialogue, promote peace, and build friendship.
That was Zhao Yunfei reporting from Qingdao. For more on this, we're joined by Swara Singh. He's professor of international relations at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Thank you, Professor Singh. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Liu, for having me on your program.
Professor, first of all, what's the significance of having maritime dialogues among the West Pacific, especially among, you know, the navies of different countries?
Clearly, over decades, human activity has moved from continents to oceans. Now, so increasingly, we see engagement with oceans. But of course, this has also resulted in challenges from the oceans. For example, there are territorial disputes. In the region that we are discussing, Western Pacific, there are choke points, and there are possibilities of accidents, of environmental disasters, oil spills, piracy. So all the major countries, stakeholders in the region, the littoral states, the island states, archipelagic states, their navies must constantly be in touch with each other. And since 2004 of Indian Ocean tsunami, navies world over has shifted focus to issues like mutual familiarization, domain knowledge, rescue operations, humanitarian assistance, naval diplomacy. And that is where symposiums are a place where countries come to, you know, talk to each other and share views, even when they may have mutually sometimes opposing views of how regional issues should be tackled. And this symposium of the Western Pacific Naval Symposium is since 1988, partly because this is the region which is most active. Western Pacific littoral has been the most rapidly transforming region, and that itself also throws up its own challenges. And I think symposium is a very useful place then. You're seeing that the Chief of Indo-Pacific Naval Command is there. Of course, Vice Minister of Central Military Commission is there. These are rare opportunities because very often important military engagements between China and U.S. Get postponed or cancelled. So it's an important situation where, you know, in a peaceful manner, naval officials are able to familiarize with each other and discuss their views which could be at variance with each other.
Professor, specifically about the West Pacific, what are some very contentious issues these days that need dialogue?
Very clearly, if you see the big picture, then contentions about the South China Sea are an important issue. But also because of explosive expansion of trade And we are not just talking of navies, we are also talking of shipping here. And some of the world's largest trading countries like China, largest shipping nations like China, have suddenly increased the traffic in this area. And then there are traditional choke points, traditional contentions, which are territorial claims are sometimes disputed. These create their own challenges. For example, in 2014 itself, this Western Pacific Naval Symposium was one of the first to create a code of unplanned encounters on oceans, which can increase. And now they are going a step ahead from there and thinking of how to deal with unmanned systems which they could encounter on oceans. Or even they are talking now of building some kind of Western Pacific Naval Symposium's business charter. So there are definitely emerging new challenges and also lingering past legacies which need to be addressed. And of course, for China, this is also an opportunity to talk about their, you know, Chinese understanding of how to ensure regional security. And therefore, I think it's an important occasion for China also to host this 29th edition of the symposium in Qingdao.
Well, as we heard from our reporter earlier, representatives from major stakeholders in the region are there. India sent its delegation too. Professor, what is India looking for at the West Pacific, in your opinion?
Thank you, Liu, for asking me that question, because India also has been the leading voice since 2008, when it for the first time hosted its own Indian Ocean Naval Symposium, which has again 25 members, 8 observers. China is an observer on Indian Ocean Naval Symposium. And that again, you know, rotates in terms of chair and location of these meetings. And in that sense, I think major expectations from India from this Western Pacific Symposium meeting in Qingdao would be to ensure, first of all, regional peace and stability, free and fair access to oceans, secure sea lanes, threats of piracy are handled together. Because, you know, as Chinese say in their new security concept since 1990s, no nation, however powerful, can handle all challenges by itself. So nations right. must work together. And that is where India would like to see that there's a greater stability in the region. There is a maritime security assured. Access to oceans is not threatened either by pirates or by any interstate confrontations or contentions. And it is in that kind of environment that India, which is emerging economy now, it's already fifth largest, going to be third largest economy, is also expanding its own international trade. And peace and security of sea lanes is very important. And I think on that issue, India and China have very similar interests and perhaps similar strategies as to how these challenges should be tackled.
Professor, we have about a minute and a half to wrap up the conversation. So briefly, can you comment on China's security concept of common, comprehensive, cooperative, and sustainable security for the region? What does that entail, and what's the significance of that?
I think China clearly, with its nearly 20 trillion economy, for about nearly two decades now, world's largest trading country, has an important say as to how regional security should be organized. And as I mentioned, from 1990s on itself, China had started focusing on multilateralism as a frame for ensuring security, had started saying that nations must cooperate and work together to ensure security. No single nation can ensure security. And now President Xi has been talking about Global Security Initiative, which again I understand was in the discussion at this Western Pacific Naval Symposium in Qingdao. So China, being a very, very influential, powerful, large-sized economy, I think has a very important say as to how that security should be organized. And it is important for all other stakeholders then to engage Chinese thinking on the subject so that they can find out how they can cooperate or at least coordinate in terms of ensuring regional security in this very, very vibrant littoral called the Western Pacific.
Thank you, Professor. We appreciate your time and insight. That was Swara Singh, Professor of International Relations at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Coming up, we'll take a look at China's fiscal revenue in the first quarter. For more discussions, you can follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. We'll be right back after a short break.
Music.
Welcome. I'm Elaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China's general public budget revenue sustained recovery momentum during the year's first quarter. According to the Ministry of Finance, the central government collected about 6.1 trillion yuan in revenue, up 2.2% year-on-year. Tax revenue totaled 4.9 trillion yuan, down 4.9% from a year ago. Tax revenue from cultural and tourism consumption saw faster growth, with a nearly 45% increase in the accommodation and catering sectors. General public budget spending expanded by 2.9% in the first 3 months, with social security, employment, and education remaining the primary areas of expenditure. The ministry says it will continue to implement a proactive fiscal policy to bolster the momentum of economic recovery. For more, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation.
So, Dr. Zhou, China's fiscal revenue grew about 2.2% in the first quarter of this year. So how do you view it? And what does the latest number tell us about the impact of China's fiscal policy support on the economy?
We know that fiscal policy is a really important one for the market to get some signals from the government. So the government is trying to set some signal that what kind of direction that the country will going to be. As a fiscal revenue, as you mentioned, that we have some growth compared with last year, the same quarter. I think it's a real good signal for us to understand that the economy is recovering. We know that from many other statistics for the first quarter, that infrastructure and investment, consumers are all coming back. So we see that it is a good start of this year, and we are seeing that the government is able to spend more money to trying to give some direction to the market and have a better support for some of the weak part of this market.
And many of the pressure is now actually on the local governments, Dr. Zhou, and some of them are fiscally challenged. So what can they do to optimize their spending structure and scale back the costs?
Yeah, I agree with you that the pressures are mostly in the local parts. Actually, it is also some of the reason that we have suffered a lot in the COVID, and a lot of efforts has been paid by the local government to try to make a good support for the society. Well, that it's a very important time for us to try to think about what can we do to improve the status of the local government. So we know that the real estate is one of the very important pillars for the local government, but it is not as strong as before. While it is still recovering, we should not only try to depend on the real estate for a longer term. So many of the local government is trying to think about how can we have a better and higher quality of development, trying to find some new sectors, the digitalization of the traditional sectors, and also trying to give a better support from the new energy. So I think that the local government is a really important part of China because they are doing something different from the before. Because in the past, we know that local government are trying to do the similar things, but now they are trying to explore different directions. Like some of them are trying to have a better opening up to some of the ASEAN countries, but others will trying to have a better integration of the different areas and trying to be better urbanization. So I think that they are trying to find some different ways, and that is definitely not that easy, but we are still count on them because it is really important to find some more diversified growth in the future.
So based on what we've seen in quarter one, so what is your perspective on where China's fiscal policy might be heading to? I mean, where the money is going to be spent on?
Yeah, actually, it's one of the very important and stable commitments by the Chinese government that we will try to have a better quality of the new quality development or productivities. So I think that is a kind of a very wide definition. It's not only limited in several sectors. So many of the fiscal policies is trying to give signals to the market. I don't think that it is only the government should be able or, you know, to be responsible to this development change, but they are sending some signals. So the market, I mean, the private investment and also the investment from foreign countries, they will join this market trying to enlarge and leverage the development growth and abilities. So these are some of the directions. And then another one is definitely to protect the benefits of the small and medium-sized enterprises and those poor people. We still have so many differences in different regions, which we're trying to give them more support on the better development in the coming, the coming months this year.
And the finance ministry says they will support the tech-led industrial innovation and show up the technological innovation and manufacturing development. So why is it important now?
China is a very important manufacturing country. We have so many manufacturing demands. I mean, many of them are coming from other countries, but we should not only try to stay in the same way as before. So a lot of innovation is needed to support the upgrade of the manufacturing. Maybe it's not that easy because they need more money to have more risks at the beginning. But if we have enough scale of the economy, it will provide us with a better support and a more sustainable growth. So I think that is the reason why most of the, you know, the investment should be based on not only on the normal ways about something to do with the tech related sectors.
And in quarter one, the actual use of foreign capital or FDI reached over 300 billion yuan or 42 billion US dollars. So how do you explain it? And what are the main factors for the FDI continuously flow into the Chinese market?
Yeah, if we compare this data with the global data, I think that is quite very impressive because China's attraction for the FDIs is much better than many of the other countries, including some of the developed countries. So I think that it's a very simple reason because the FDI really believe that China is going to give them more support and more, you know, promise for the development in the future. China is not only trying to make the market better and bigger, but also trying to make it stable. So I think a lot of practices has been implemented to open the market wider, and we are better support the innovation-based investment, and we are supporting many of the Chinese companies to cooperate with the FDIs. And that is definitely one of the most important reasons that we need to have a longer-term return based on the investment. Mm-hmm. So many of the FDI, they come back. They are trying to improve their investment here and reinvest after they got some of the profits here in China.
And if you see the securities market, we do see they are coming back. I mean, investors are turning attention to the China market. And data from the HSBC shows that over 90% of emerging market funds are starting to increase their holdings in the Chinese market. And in the first quarter, the cumulative net inflow of northbound funds exceeded 68 billion yuan. This is far exceeding the entire 2023. To A shares. So do you think there are clear signs of global capital flying back to China?
Yeah, I think that they are real smart. I think many of the funds, they based on the very sensitive, the data from the market, also what they are thinking of that, the investment. It has a little bit different from the longer term, the foreign direct investment. For the security market, they are based on some short term and some of the maybe middle term of the return. So I think that a lot of capital come back to China because they really see the potential for the development. Maybe, when we're looking at some of the regulations, it's changed and it has put some pressure on the price of the stock market. But in the longer term, it will have a better support for the better structured, different kind of companies listed in the stock market. So many of the opportunities are here in China, and the administrations are giving better opening up policies to give more opportunities for the investment. So they're seeing the opportunity and they come back.
Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombiev Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management, at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The main ruling party in the Maldives has won the parliamentary election in the country. Local media reported Monday that the People's National Congress won 70 out of 93 seats to take full control of the parliament. The Maldivian Democratic Party, the main opposition party led by former President Ibrahim Mohamed Solih, won only 15 seats. The PNC had secured seats in former MDP strongholds, including the capital, Male. For more, we're joined by Hamza Rifat Hossein. He is news anchor, Indus News, Islamabad in Pakistan. Thank you, Hamza, for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, first of all, how do you see the occasion of this election in the Maldives?
Well, I think the Maldivian people have chosen their respective leadership after considering a considerable amount of factors. I think the first one is the fact that the other opposition parties were not necessarily yielding the desired results for the Maldivian people, whether it is regarding, you know, concerns of inundation of their islands, whether it's regarding concerns regarding diversifying their economy away from tourism, or whether it's concerns regarding expanded Indian influence in the Maldives. So I think it's a momentous occasion for them. It reflects the social contract between the Maldivian people as well as the ruling party. And I think it's going to usher in a period of sustained economic growth. I would like to point out that the Maldives has the highest human development index rating in South Asia. It is a tourism hub, and their citizens, despite income inequality, enjoy sustained high standards of living. That is only going to be made possible, or whether it's going to sustain itself, if the ruling party continues with its economic reform agenda.
We're talking about that moving forward. What do you think will be Muizu's policy priorities?
Well, I think Muizu, he has a PhD from the University of Leeds. He is obsessed with economic development. He believes that structural reforms in the housing sector is extremely important in the Maldives. Now, we do understand that Maldives is not as large a country as China is, for example, so they do have shortage of land. And many of their islands are susceptible towards inundation. And that could actually result in, you know, sustainability challenges. So what Muizu is proposing is to make sure that, land which is prone to inundation could actually be used for agricultural purposes. And that is something that could result in increased revenue for the Maldivian population. And the other problem is to address the housing crisis, which has been beyond the capital, Male. You do see lots of people who are homeless. And that can actually be addressed if the government prioritizes social policies and welfare policies which are directed at the people of Maldives and has a trickle-down effect on the local population. So I think structural reform, reforms in the housing sector, and ensuring that the Maldives gets out of this persistent challenge of inundation due to climate change are going to be the three major areas that Mohamed Muizu would be prioritizing.
Those do sound urgent problems for the country. Muizu has been known for his foreign policy change of moving closer toward China since he took office. How do you see that, and what do you think might be some of his considerations for the change?
Well, I think moving close to China is because of economic development, but I think the single largest factor is Indian influence in Maldives. And Indian influence has been pretty much pronounced, whether it's influencing the results of the Bangladesh elections. Nepal has also complained of bullying, and I think that the Maldives is no exception to this regard. And if you take a look at South Asia in general, even, you know, my own country, Pakistan, has accused India of initiating terrorism within the country. So the Maldives has or had a very large Indian troop presence in their archipelago. And that is one of the reasons why, because of the troop presence, the foreign policy and the decisions of the sovereign government was suddenly being influenced by New Delhi or by the Narendra Modi government, which is known for its right-wing Hindutva socially exclusionary agenda. So this was obviously going to be a threat to the Maldives' sovereignty and its ability to align its foreign policy with China. Now, China is a major economic hub. It is a country which is investing heavily in regional corridors, whether it's the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor or the BCIM, the Bangladesh-China-India-Myanmar Corridor, for that matter. And it does have the financial capital and the influence which could actually benefit the Maldives to a large extent.
Mm.
So India's militarization of the Maldives is one of the reasons why Mohamed Moeizu has decided that siding with China, which is more economic in its orientation, which believes in the prosperity of the local population, which believes in structural and economic reforms, as well as building regional corridors, is the right panacea for the Maldives to actually, economically prosper, as compared to siding with India, which obviously has nefarious designs in South Asia and wants an expanded military presence to counter China.
Mm. Well, Hamza, how have regional countries in the Indian Ocean responded to this election, particularly in your country? And also, how do you think Moeizu's election or the victory of his party in this election will affect, you know, the geostrategic consideration in the Indian Ocean?
Well, I think, let me speak about Pakistan. Pakistan has welcomed Mohamed Moeizu's, ascension to power. I think that Pakistan has been very receptive to the idea that he has a pro-China outlook. Mm. And Pakistan has also been very receptive to the fact that Maldives has adopted an India out campaign prior to the elections, that Indian militarization needs to finish. When we speak about the Indian Ocean in general, I think the Indian Ocean is a major trading hub. It is a key part of the Asia-Pacific strategy, which China actually believes in, and it has immense amount of resource potential. But possibilities of conflict obviously remain with India and Pakistan being nuclear powers and have an expanded naval and submarine base. So I think that Moeizu's election in such a strategically significant and geographically significant country can result in tangible benefits, because he would be oriented towards economic cooperation with China and the other countries, and try to even reinvigorate SARC, which also includes Afghanistan, which is facing immense amount of economic problems as well. So I think most regional countries, as well as those in the Indian Ocean, I mean, the only country which borders, which has a maritime border with the Maldives, is Sri Lanka.
Mm.
And Sri Lanka is actually recovering from under the prime ministership of Ranil Wickremesinghe. So there is immense amount of potential, and many of these countries have actually welcomed Moeizu's rise, because Indian militarization is a huge, huge problem for all of these countries, and India's hegemonic designs as well. So many countries view Moeizu's rise as potentially leading to a more integrated and economically prosperous Indian Ocean, as well as South Asia.
Mm. Well, how do you think India will, perceive this, the result of this election?
Well, the Indians would obviously not be very happy.
Mm.
They are pretty much critical of any pro-China government, whether it's in Bangladesh or whether it's in Pakistan, whether it's elsewhere. And the Maldives, India has obviously viewed Maldives as just a tourist destination, which does not necessarily have an immense amount of economic clout. And it's considered to be, sadly, the Indians view it as a very insignificant country that they can build their military bases on. So the Maldives have rebuffed that idea, and that goes against Narendra Modi's or the BJP government's agenda of expanded economic, militarized clout in the Indian Ocean as well as in South Asia. So the Indians are obviously very unhappy, and they should be unhappy, because it's not the Indian age, it's the Chinese age, or it's the age of regional cooperation and economic cooperation, not for militarization.
Mm. Well, this is a very interesting topic. Thank you. We appreciate your time and insight. That was Hamza Rifat Hossein, news anchor, Indus News, Islamabad, Pakistan. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The World Anti-Doping Agency has defended its decision to clear 23 Chinese swimmers who tested positive for a banned heart medication ahead of the 2021 Tokyo Olympics. This comes after the case was revealed by media outlets, including the New York Times and German broadcaster ARD, which accused WADA of shielding Chinese athletes and failing to hold them accountable. WADA said in an earlier statement that it had accepted the findings of a Chinese investigation, which said the positive tests were caused by contamination at a hotel kitchen and the athletes were innocent. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin on Monday described the media reports as disinformation and a misrepresentation and affirmed WADA's decision. For more on this, my colleague Zhao Ying joins us again in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying.
Thanks for having me.
Now, walk us through what happened, you know, with these Chinese swimmers and WADA. Why did WADA decide they were cleared to compete despite the positive test results?
Yes, well, the situation goes back to early 2021, and according to reports, 23 Chinese swimmers tested positive for TMZ, which is a banned heart medication, and that was during a national competition in China. And this raised red flags because TMZ can enhance an athlete's performance, and that was also the banned substance at the heart of the controversy, including Russian figure skater Kamila Valieva at the 2022 Winter Olympics. But the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, ultimately cleared these swimmers to compete in the 2021 Tokyo Olympics, and their decision came after the Chinese anti-doping agency investigated and concluded the positive tests were due to contaminated food from a hotel kitchen where the team was staying. And due to COVID-19 restrictions, WADA couldn't investigate the case on the ground at that time. But after receiving the Chinese authorities' findings and based on scientific evidence, WADA determined they couldn't disprove contaminations as the source. They also considered that under the specific circumstances, the swimmers wouldn't be considered negligent. And they said there was no evidence to contradict Chinese findings. And also the levels of TMZ found in the swimmers' urine samples were too low to afford a performance-enhancing benefit. So they accepted the Chinese anti-doping agency's decision and allowed the swimmers to compete. So actually the case itself isn't new, but it only recently gained widespread attention due to those media coverage, which you know, came right before the Paris Olympics.
Well, Zhao Ying, is there any precedent for similar contamination instance in anti-doping history?
Yes, there are previous cases where athletes have successfully argued contamination from food or supplements. U.S. swimmer Madison Cox's situation in 2018 is a good example. Her initial positive test for TMZ was traced back to a multivitamin, and her ban was reduced. In 2019, Australian swimmer Shanna Jack received a doping suspension for 4 years after testing positive to a banned substance. But the Court of Arbitration for Sport eventually halved the ban to 2 years after finding she didn't intentionally ingest the drug. And Jack suggested she could have taken contaminated supplements. And also, retired Australian swimmer Breton Rickard avoided punishment in 2021 due to low levels of a prohibited substance in his samples, also potentially caused by contamination. So this raises an interesting point about media coverage in doping cases, because contamination incidents do happen, but there can be a double standard there because some media outlets might be more critical and scrutinize contamination claims from other countries while giving their own athletes the benefit of the doubt in similar situations.
Well, that's interesting because we have a case here. Travis Tygart, the CEO of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, criticized WADA for not taking action against the Chinese swimmers and accused them of shielding athletes from consequences. So how did WADA respond to this?
Well, Wada said it is astonished by the outrageous, completely false and defamatory remarks made by the head of the U.S. anti-doping agency, who made wrongful accusations against Wada over the case. And Wada highlights several key points. First, they reviewed scientific evidence and consulted with external experts to assess the contamination theory. And second, due to COVID, they couldn't conduct their own on-site investigation in China. And third, based on the available data, WADA couldn't disprove the possibility of contamination, and the low TMZ levels further supported this explanation. And fourth, given the specific circumstance, WADA concluded the athletes wouldn't be considered negligent. And also, WADA mentioned that the USADA had contacted WADA in early 2023 based on a tip it had received about alleged cover-up involving these cases, but was unable to provide any evidence. And WADA also points out that USADA itself has accepted similar contamination explanations in cases involving American athletes like swimmer Madison Cox, and they argue that WADA applies the anti-doping code consistently regardless of nationality. And WADA also said of the USADA CEO allegations are potentially motivated and delivered with the intention of undermining WADA's work to protect clean and clean sport around the world. And he said following this false allegation, it has no choice but to refer this matter to its legal counsel for further action.
Well, we have about a minute to wrap up, but Zhaoying, how should they distinguish legitimate concerns from potential attempts to discredit China's sports programs?
First of all, I think legitimate concerns about doping should be backed by verifiable evidence, but apparently USADA lacks that kind of evidence. And also, I think a country's past record with doping can influence how current allegations are perceived, right? And China has faced criticism in the past, but the U.S. anti-doping system has its own limitations, which can create a perception of double standards. For example, some major U.S. professional leagues and NCAA operate under their own anti-doping rules, which are not directly overseen by WADA. And also, the timing of these accusations just before the Paris Olympics also makes people think whether these reports are primarily focused on fair play or have a political agenda.
Well, this is a very interesting but rather complex issue. Thank you, Zhaoying. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.